From KCRW, this is DNA, Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. At the LA Auto Show, Volvo gets buzz for showing up without any cars.
It was such a bold statement from them, because there are a lot of manufacturers who say they're bringing vehicles that are autonomous or electric, and yet they don't have them. And I think what they've proven there is that everybody is saying they have things that don't exist.
And the new Porsche 911 wows people with its new cup holder. But first, if you live in Malibu, you live with the knowledge that your life and home run the risk of fire. But even those who have lived through past infernos say nothing compares to the Woolsey fire. It rampaged its way from Simi Valley to the beach, and it has left hundreds of people homeless. So what happens now? Will the terror cause people to leave for good? If people stay, will the design and siting of homes have to change? We went to Malibu to find out.
Hey, I'm Claudia Taylor, and I live on Sea Lane in Malibu, and I've lived here for 20 years.
And we started with a tour of some of the devastation with longtime residents Claudia and Rob Taylor.
In fact, we feel extremely lucky because we were able to fight it off. We fought it off at all of our perimeters until it got too hot and we had to evacuate. So the original evacuation notice was at 7 a.m. We wound up actually leaving at about 7:30, 8 p.m. when our eyebrows were getting singed, and we just had to make a run for it. So as you can see, it came right on this hill down.
Because we're now out on PCH, just near Paradise Cove.
You could see it was burning right here on the highway. Just absolutely terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
Since you've been here for decades, you pretty much know everybody in Malibu. How are people reacting? Are people choosing to pick up and go or rebuild?
Oh, I think the pioneer spirit here is strong. You know, we may be perceived as a bunch of marshmallows, but we are fierce. We are fierce. And in the face of these flames, we fought to save our homes. I don't want to be like Star Tours, but here's Nick Nolte's house that burned right here on the corner. This is really a tragic shame. You see all of that in here. Right now, we're going to go by, I'm sure that you know of Jay Griffith. This was his original home here. It used to sit right here. And it extended through two little valleys. So that's all gone.
Jay Griffith is a prominent LA landscape designer. Most of his plantings have been torched. And next door to that property sits the remains of a house. Walls are twisted and bent. Most everything is reduced to ash and rubble. Just a chimney stack still stands and some metal patio tables and chairs.
This is a Catherine Marinaro's home. We're on Bush Drive. This was just one of many not overly grand homes. People have a perception that we're all mansions here, and far from it. This was a family home that was beautifully remodeled, and I'm going to walk you out to a bocce court that we've, you know, many nights sat and enjoyed a sunset and drank some lovely wine and enjoyed family time, and it's all just gone. So I'm going to just take a break, get out of the car, and then we're going to meet Mikey Pearson, who's our new council member, who also was previously on the Planning Commission.
So now we meet Mike, also known as Mikey Pearson. He explains that after he told his community to evacuate, he and his son Emmett stayed behind and fought to save homes.
My son's amazing. I have to give him a lot of credit. He's 23, knows everything about fire sciences. I've fought a lot of fires. But he laid out everything, our fire hoses, which we've owned, all our gear, our safety plan, our escape routes, everything. And then we went up the street to where the fire was going to enter the neighborhood and waited for it. And that's when other people came out and they had fire gear too. And we teamed up. And for most of the day, about five of us were fighting the fire. But if it had caught those first few homes on fire, it just would have dominoed the entire neighborhood, without a doubt.
So we're meeting you at a house that has been decimated by fire. What are you going to tell the homeowner here?
I'm coming onto the city council as a planning commissioner for the last almost 7 years. So I've been one of the people approving homes built all over Malibu. The message I'm going to deliver to Malibu, and I'm not the only one, is we really need to think about how we rebuild. if we build the same homes in the same locations with the same landscaping, they're going to burn again. And nobody's going to come help us. Fires are too big, they're too hot, and they're too fast. And there's too many of them at the same time to expect the fire department to come save our homes. So I think the real answer is, the hard answer is, we have to make homes, we have to build homes that can defend themselves overall. No home's completely fireproof overall, but we can do things that generally aren't happening to give homes a much better chance to survive, because we're in a high fire zone.
And that, what are those things?
The most vulnerable home in my neighborhood was up on a hill, no one defended it, right? It's just in the worst location. It is sitting there perfect and doesn't even look like it got smoky. It's basically a concrete home with a metal roof. Even the planters are concrete with great brush clearance, no big trees around the house. That home went through the fire by itself and is standing there. I'd love to give people a tour of this home. I don't even know who owns it, but it's a fantastic example of a beautiful home that withstood the fire all by itself. Now, not that homes like that can't burn down. They can. But this is a great example of a home that could defend itself.
And what every time there's a fire in fire-prone territory like this, there are critics that come out and say people shouldn't even be building here at all. What do you say to that argument?
Well, I say there's a side of that that's absolutely true. But the reality is, this community, it's been my home my entire life. We're not leaving. So I think we need to adapt to the environment. And the environment is those hotter, faster fires that they're not going away. So if we're going to build here, we really got to think about what that looks like. And I think it's an important discussion for this town to have.
Sure. And you mentioned, you know, really sturdy concrete and a metal roof. How about prefab? There's some buzz now building about doing essentially metal container homes, essentially. Does Malibu Planning Department even allow for, say, a prefab type unit?
Absolutely. There is a lot of different technologies to look at. And I'm getting a lot of people sending me their ideas on what works for their community, different architects, different manufacturers. So yes, the conversation is much bigger than concrete and metal roofs, for sure. Prefabs are allowed to a degree, but they have to be on a slab. I very much believe in certain kinds of technology in homes that Malibu doesn't allow now, such as sort of the tiny home movement and things like that that would really be helpful right now, container homes, etc. So that's another part of the conversation for sure.
That was Mike Pearson, incoming Malibu Council member. After talking with him, we headed off again with longtime residents Claudia and Rob Taylor.
So now we're turning left on Harvester Road. This is the Pietro's house right here, burned to the ground. So many friends have lost everything. A lot of eucalyptus trees are culprits here because eucalyptus trees are non-native and they're also full of flammable oils and sap. I think the bottom line is this. So we're talking about who's going to rebuild and who's going to leave. I think a lot of older people who are underinsured, who don't have mortgages, aren't required to carry fire insurance, and don't have the kind of like future time available or resources to rebuild, will most likely sell their lots and move on. Younger families or people that have been here for 20, 30, 40 years will definitely dig deep and rebuild using some smarter fireproof techniques. So this whole parking lot here, Zuma Beach, this was the initial evacuation zone before it got completely inundated with smoke. So this whole stretch, which during the summer is filled with beachgoers and people enjoying their weekend at the beach, was filled with panicked, frightened residents with their animals. And keep in mind that Malibu is an equestrian area. There were hundreds of horses that needed to be rescued.
We're going to now move on and go down Blue Water, which is an amazing street that lost about 10 houses, and we have another, you know, Malibu celebrity who lives there, who shall not be named, but we all call him Bob. How's that? Okay. So, at any rate, his house remains. Many of his outbuildings didn't. but about 20 houses on this whole street just absolutely are reduced to rubble. Absolutely reduced.
So far out on the point. Again, people were caught so unaware and unprepared for what turned into a huge firestorm. Look at this. Gone. Gone. Gone.
That was Rob and Claudia Taylor. Claudia is a freelance writer and designer. Rob is a director and editor, and they are longtime Malibu residents. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. As you just heard, animals are part of life in Malibu, and not just dogs, cats, and horses. Stinkerbell and Tiptoes are two pigs who are part of a menagerie at the Malibu home of Colette Brooks. It's near Cane and June Road above Paradise Cove. Colette and partner Brett Shaw, a contractor and architect, are reflecting on what is left on her property, what comes next, and lessons learned from the capricious fire.
We evacuated on Friday with all of the horses, three horses, four dogs, and I had no way of taking two 400-pound pigs. It's a thing. I mean, you have to build chutes and whatnot, and we had a couple hours to really evacuate. So I locked them in a concrete and steel paddock and just crossed my fingers. As you can tell, they were untouched, and miraculously, my home, the main home, was untouched. Everything else, including the guest house, which is a couple acres away, burned to the ground. The fire just came through here and took everything out. Why it didn't go there and why it didn't hit my house. Luck of the draw. We have succulents around the main house. We've got a buffer of gravel. The pig paddock is not wood, although the barns are wood with a steel roof, but the pig paddocks are steel and concrete. Maybe it was my little St. Francis statue that I had watching over the animals. And maybe it was just the shift of the winds and luck and, you know, I don't know, because it was so random.
Sure. It must be a great relief that the pigs survived.
Oh, my God. I heard through somebody who stayed back that the pigs survived. So when we came back late Saturday night and it was dark and I saw them or heard them first snorting and oinking amongst this debris, my heart lifted. Yeah, I was just so grateful. They've actually become quite popular here in the neighborhood. What I discovered after we came back, and that was, I was only able to come back Saturday night and then not for a few days and then just very randomly. People who stayed back heard about the pigs, and they were coming and bringing vegetables and fruits and just the outpouring of support and help and love from strangers who just wanted to stay strangers. It was just all kind of about the pigs. So if there's a silver lining to this, it was the community just really mobilizing to help each other and four-legged creatures, and it was beautiful. So we have new friends, and
there was so much food one time. We came back, and there was a huge bucket in the center of their pen filled with vegetables, and they weren't eating it. It's the first time I've ever seen the pigs turn down food.
May I say they had pigged out?
Yes, exactly. Right. They were in hog heaven, as we like to say. Exactly right.
Your guest house didn't survive.
No.
You two are now talking about what to build on that site, what kind of construction you're going to embark on. What are you thinking? What are you planning?
Well, we have to follow the requirements for one-hour walls on the perimeter of the walls, which give a little extra protection for the building, allowing it to maintain itself in a fire just a little extra time.
Well, that sort of blows my theory of wanting to get a straight-up steel container home, because we would have to then retrofit it with one-hour walls. And I actually, both from a functional standpoint and an aesthetic standpoint, I like the look of a steel container prefab home that we can kind of put together with, like, Legos. But if we have to put a one-hour wall around it, it sort of defeats the purpose. So I'm going to toss it back to Brett.
Right. It's just not all the cost benefit of going to a container home is then offset by retrofitting it to meet the one-hour requirements.
So construction costs are already astronomical in LA because there's a lot of construction going on. are people's insurance payouts going to be able to cover the cost of reconstruction?
My guest house, unfortunately, was underinsured. So what I received is probably a third of what I'm going to need to rebuild.
Right. And the construction costs, we're in a building boom right now in L.A., and you can't build under $450, $475 a square foot now. And the insurance companies, their numbers are like $200, $250, maybe $300 a square foot. And that, and sometimes even less, depending on how old the structure was and how the policy is structured. So people are going to have to make choices about maybe scaling back, maybe not doing all the outbuildings and consolidate the budget to build one building, or get loans, which is unfortunate at this time.
That was Brett Shaw, architect and contractor, and Colette Brooks, branding consultant. And as you heard, Brooks didn't lose everything on her property, but many people did, including Jefferson Zuma J. Wagner. He's the longtime owner of Zuma J's Surf Shop on the Pacific Coast Highway. He's also a councilman and the incoming mayor of Malibu.
I lost my entire home. I was in Latigo Canyon, and that home is gone. I fought it for almost 12 hours, and I saved the home through the storm with the fire apparatus and appliances that I had. The problem I had physically was my aluminum ladder melted. I couldn't get access to my roof. The embers landed on the roof, and I lost my home from the roof downward. And I was fighting it until I ran out of water.
Oh, my goodness. Had you lived there for many, many years?
I built it in 90. I was the architect. I built it in 90. And I just paid the mortgage off 2 years ago.
And how about your health? You were right there in the midst of the fire and the smoke.
I suffered from carbon monoxide poisoning. And I was in the intensive care unit at UCLA for a couple days. And then they released me, and now I'm on rehab.
On rehab, back at work,
yeah.
In your surf store. So is there a sense of kind of life goes on?
That's, for me, that's the positive effects of a community like Malibu, where you can go into a restaurant and they'll serve you a lunch or a meal and say, we'll take care of it later. You can see piles of clothing that people have generously donated to us. Because we lost everything. So that spirit is alive inside of me, and that's kind of keeps my drive level up and my hope levels up.
Are you planning to rebuild?
Of course.
Are you looking at building the same home, or are you going to redesign?
No, I would do everything identical, because the process will be easier if you just duplicate what was there.
You're mayor pro tem. You're going to be dealing with a lot of your constituents who are going to be worried and wondering, what are you going to tell them?
I'm going to be leading shoulder to shoulder with these people. I'm the only council member or mayor that lost a home in this tragedy, and I will be going through the exact same experiences that all these other hundreds of homeowners are going to be going through. I'll be going through the exact same thing. I'll be sharing their misery and their successes.
Are you sensing any frustration among people that the process is not moving fast enough?
There is a great deal of frustration in the community. It's understandable. The process for me as an administrator and an elected is to educate the people and bring these things forward in a process that's easy to follow. Let's go to step one, debris clean up first. Then let's move on.
Why is that such an issue?
Stuff inside homes, like what I ingested in my lungs, are carcinogenic, and they change molecular structure when they're burned and melted. And those materials can leach into the ground, onto the streets, and into the environment. So you need to get that out of there before you start doing anything. And the proper way to do it is with a certified company that does that.
And lastly, was there anything that was sort of incinerated in the fire in your home that you sort of are particularly sad to have lost?
I lost the only full international surf wax collection that a book was written about. It's been in the Library of Congress. I lost that collection. And I lost my comic book collection, which was my retirement. And I lost my book on the Malibu Pier, all the data that was given to me by Ron Ringe. And all that 12 chapter is gone.
I'm so sorry to hear that. Who is Ron Ringe?
one of the founding members of Malibu, the Ringe family. They were the ones that originally owned this whole rancho. He and I collaborated. He gave me all the data, the physical data, and I put the 12 chapters together.
And you don't have it on any kind of computer anywhere?
No, I wrote it in long form and had the kids here at the store type it out. We had, when the pier was built, the Malibu Pier here in the Adamson House, all that historical data is gone, lost in the fire. But I'll try and recreate it.
That was Jefferson Wagner. He's owner of Zuma J Surf Shop on Pacific Coast Highway, and he's mayor pro tem for the city of Malibu. Tonight, the city council will host its first regular meeting since the fires. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, why is a cup holder so important to the new Porsche 911? And other questions posed by the LA Auto Show.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. The LA Auto Show is at the Convention Center in downtown through Sunday. But this year's showcase of cool new cars got off to a less than celebratory start. First came the very bad news about GM slashing thousands of jobs. Then Volvo, famed for its family-friendly, super-safe vehicles, showed up for the press preview without any cars. More on that shortly. Add to that, auto shows themselves have been declining in significance in past years. Trade shows are expensive and car companies can release models online. So why even attend? Well, we are Sharon Carty. She's senior editor of Automotive News.
LA is always really important because this is where a lot of automakers talk about their green technology and just technology in general. And then also because it's LA and it's Southern California, we get to see really cool cars. So a lot of sports cars that come out here, and it's generally a really fun show.
Anything particularly cool that appeals to you?
Well, the new 911, Porsche 911, it's a great car, but it's almost like the iPhone of cars, right? It's like iterates. There's never really a gigantic redesign. It's just sort of, you know, little new things here and there. And so it's really fun to see this iconic design that keeps getting tweaked.
But you compared it to an iPhone. Does that mean that it's now somewhat like a Tesla? Is it all smart technology?
You know, every car right now is all about technology. All of the automakers are focusing primarily on their technology issues. Volvo actually doesn't have any cars here, and they're promoting that come to our stand and take a look at all of the cool technology we have, and making a big deal out of the fact that they're not showing any cars. So tech is where it's at.
This decision by Volvo to not show any cars at all during the press and trade days made headlines. A journalist we met there named Brian Grant, producer of the YouTube series New Car Spin, told us that he loved the irony of their display.
It was such a bold statement from them, because there are a lot of manufacturers who say they're bringing vehicles that are autonomous or electric, and yet they don't have them. And I think what they've proven there is that everybody is saying they have things that don't exist.
Now, Volvo did bring out some cars for the public days of the LA Auto Show, but still, we were intrigued by this bold statement of theirs. So off we went to check out their display and found a big crowd staring at a blonde wood kinetic sculpture that spells out the words, "This is not a car." So what was the point of all this? We caught up with Robin Page. He's head of design for Volvo.
I think people are like, okay, this is, you know, challenging to the industry. I mean, if you look around, we've been presenting cars in this way for many, many years now, and the industry is changing, and the millennial kind of generation is really influencing how we communicate and what the focus is. And what they really call out for is connecting their lives with the car, you know, their phone, their needs, their, for instance, Amazon delivery is a classic that they want, you know, the car to help in their lifestyle. And also we've shown a concept which is called the 360C concept that shows a vision of autonomous drive in the future. And what we explored with that is that you have a VR headset, and we have animated four different scenarios in the interior. First of all, a Scandinavian living room, and this is like a commuter vehicle. Then the second one is actually an alternative to an office space. So imagine, instead of renting an office in, say, LA, you would use this vehicle. You can have a meeting in it. You can project your presentation onto the side of the glass. You can have a coffee. There's a coffee machine inside. Then the third one is actually based around a VIP kind of lounge. So you go from your hotel with your clients or friends to the restaurant. You can have drinks and snacks, and you have this fantastic light show projected onto the ceiling. And then the last one, which is the most controversial, is actually a sleeping car. So this is an alternative to short-haul flights. Basically, it picks you up from your home or your workplace and takes you through the night to your destination. And you can sleep in it, very much like business class travel in aircraft is in an autonomous vehicle. So this vehicle has no driver. It has no steering wheel. It is on a full autonomous system. And we see this actually quite realistically in the near future.
But how near future? As we understand it, the irony of the "this is not a car" message that you guys have adopted is that none of this really exists yet. And it's the same for other automakers.
So there's lots of questions still to be answered. And we are saying that is still very much the case, but we're working towards something. So basically, we put a stake in the ground and said, that's the vision we want to get to, and to get people engaged in the discussions that we need to get there in the future.
That was Robin Page. He's head of design at Volvo. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Now, aside from the new technologies, people go to the auto show to ogle gorgeous cars that are fun to drive. And the consensus seemed to be that the top example of that is the Porsche 911.
So the 911 is a success story of an icon 55 years in the making. The first prototype of the car was shown at the Frankfurt Auto Show in 1963, and this now is the eighth generation, or interpretation, if you will, of that timeless concept.
This is Frank Wiesmann. He's a spokesman for Porsche. Now, the car may be timeless, but one of the new features of this version of the 911, they say, is a cup holder. We asked Wiesmann what's so special about that.
So we've had cup holders for a while now, actually. It's now been relocated to the center console. It used to be a position above the glove compartment that you opened. But a 911 is a lot about utility. A lot of our customers drive this car on a daily basis, and therefore it's important that the car doesn't just perform well, but also offers the convenience, like the connectivity in terms of Wi-Fi and so forth, but also innovations like the new wet mode, which warns the driver of a potentially wet road by detecting the spray in the wheel wells from a wet road, and also preconditions the stability control systems to make the car more suited to driving on a wet road.
Back to the cup holder. Is the cup holder about making concessions to an American driver? And is it also about the fact that cars just can't go so fast these days because we spend a lot of time sitting in congestion?
It is true that we sell about 30%, almost a third of our 911s in the United States every year. So the American market and its needs are certainly important to us. But it's not a specific focus of the car. It's just another one of many features to make sure the car is as usable as possible, so that the customer doesn't have to make too many concessions while still driving a pure sports car.
That was Frank Wiesmann with Porsche. The LA Auto Show continues at the Downtown Convention Center through Sunday. I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. Avishai Artsy produced and edited this program with final mix by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Laura Kondarachian. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.